time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. North Korea's Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho Monday said President Donald Trump and is predicting last week North Korea's leadership won't be around much longer, declared war on his country. The North Korean diplomat said that gives his country the right to countermeasures, including shooting down U.S. warplanes, even if they're not in North Korean airspace. White House press spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders dismissed the statement as absurd.
It's never appropriate for a country to shoot down another country's aircraft when it's over international waters. Our goal is still the same. We continue to seek the peaceful denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, doing that through both the most maximum economic and diplomatic pressures as possible at this point.
Also in Washington Monday, South Korea's Foreign Minister Kang Kyung-hwa, addressing the Center for Strategic and International Studies, said further North Korean provocations are likely and called on the U.S. to help Seoul manage the issue.
There cannot be another war in the region. There cannot be another outbreak of war on the Korean Peninsula. The consequences would be devastating, not just for the Korean Peninsula, but for Northeast Asia and indeed the whole international community.
She said there is still room for diplomacy. A Britain-based tribal advocacy group said wildlife charities like the World Wildlife Fund support so-called anti-poaching eco-squads that arrest, torture, and kill indigenous pygmy people who hunt in their ancestral forests in the Congo Basin. Survival International said since 1989, the Baka and Bayaka pygmies in Cameroon, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Central African Republic have been forced out of national parks. This is VOA News. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is scheduled to brief members of the Security Council Thursday on the violence in western Rakhine State, prompting hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims to flee Myanmar to Bangladesh. At the UN, Myanmar's Ambassador Hau Doswan cautioned against using terms like atrocities, ethnic cleansing, or genocide.
Let me be clear, Mr. President. There is no ethnic cleansing. There is no genocide. The leaders of Myanmar, who have long been striving for freedom and human rights, will not espouse such policies. We will do everything to prevent ethnic cleansing and genocide.
In Myanmar, meanwhile, security forces claim to have unearthed the bodies of another 17 Hindu villagers. It said were killed by Muslim insurgents, bringing to 45 the number discovered since Sunday. A spokesman for the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army, or ARSA, denies it was responsible, insisting it does not target civilians. The U.S. State Department says it's deeply disappointed Iraqi Kurds held a referendum on independence Monday, warning it will increase instability and hardship for the Kurdish region of Iraq. Large numbers of voters turned out to cast ballots. The Prime Minister of Iraq's regional Kurdistan government, Nerchevan Barzani, called it a historic day. He said the Kurdish people want to live peacefully and democratically. Iraq has called the referendum unconstitutional. Turkey, with a large Kurdish minority, has refused to recognize it. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan threatened to cut off the flow of oil from northern Iraq to the outside world. A new round of divorce talks between Britain and the European Union is underway, with the EU insisting first on terms of Britain's departure before moving on to London's future relations and trade with the bloc. British Prime Minister Theresa May last week proposed a two-year transition period after Britain's formal departure date of March 2019. Michel Barnier is the EU's chief negotiator.
The European Union is keen and eager to understand better how the UK government will translate the Prime Minister's speech into negotiating positions.
EU leaders are to meet next month to assess if Britain has made progress on divorce arrangements before discussing future relations with the EU. Most schools in Mexico remain closed following last week's 7.1 magnitude earthquake that killed more than 300 and damaged or destroyed hundreds of buildings. More than 44,000 schools in six states were to reopen Monday. Only about 100 in Mexico City were open, with many still not certified as safe. Brazil expected to reinstate a mining ban in a large part of the Amazon rainforest. In a victory for environmentalists, President Michel Temer's administration preparing to revoke an August decree abolishing the National Reserve of Copper and Associates, an area almost the size of Denmark. I'm Victor Beatty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barton, Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 26th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Members of Uganda's parliament condemn heavy security deployment at parliament as debate heats up over age limit.
We don't want this violation of people's rights at a parliament that is supposed to be the people's only space. Not a place where torture is meted upon members of parliament. Not a place where Ugandans will feel insecure when they come at parliament.
Winnie Chissa is an opposition leader in the Ugandan parliament. Kenya joins other nations to ban plastic bags. Gabon's government takes issue with the European Union Parliament criticism over opposition treatment. And Liberia's ambassador to the UK clarifies his alleged comments that former President Charles Taylor should be free to return home.
My interview was miscarried, most probably by the local newspapers. The comments that I made in reference to former President Taylor was simply in connection with reconciliation.
Dr. Mohammed Sharif is Liberia's ambassador to the United Kingdom, and an African refugee school in Cairo struggles to educate children. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. As the debate to amend Uganda's constitution to remove age limit heats up, members of parliament have condemned a heavy deployment of security personnel at the parliament. Leader of opposition, Winnie Chissa, says the heavy security deployment is meant to intimidate members. But the government says the security is routine to ensure MPs are safe. Mugumi Davis Rakarish reports from Kampala.
Uganda's parliament will today, Tuesday, resume business, where it is expected the discussion to whether the parliament should grant MP Raphael Magezi the go-ahead to draft a bill that seeks to amend the constitution, removing the age limit for a person standing for presidency, will be a major point of focus. The Deputy Speaker, Jacob Olanya, was forced to suspend the parliament amid this chaos and drama on Thursday as MPs could not agree to debate.
Honourable members, it looks like there are two problems here. There are two problems, and they are big problems. The first problem that members are not ready to sit. And the second problem is that the speaker is not ready to chair a parliament that does not want to sit. So, since there are two big problems which I've just enumerated, this house is adjourned to Tuesday, 2 o'clock.
The Deputy Speaker criticized the siege by the police and the army, calling it unnecessary. Uganda's leader of opposition in parliament, Winnie Chissa, agrees. She says security forces went overboard.
We don't want this violation of people's rights at a parliament that is supposed to be the people's only space. This is the only free space that Ugandans must have. This is a space that should be looked at as a sanctified place. Not a place where torture is meted upon members of parliament. Not a place where Ugandans will feel insecure when they come at parliament.
Uganda's constitution sets the age range to stand for presidency at 35 to 75 years of age. Therefore, President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni, who will be 76 in 2021, cannot run for the presidency again. Opposition members and others against the expected bill say the amendment is aimed at ensuring President Museveni, who has been in power since 1986, is eligible to contest. Parliamentarian Gerard Karuhanga says Ugandans want to see a peaceful transition of power.
What we think today is a very indicative moment that Ugandans are saying that whoever wants to manipulate the constitution is going to destabilize this country. Let whoever has eyes see, whoever has ears listen to Ugandans. They are so keen on ensuring that we retain our constitution.
Obiga Mario Kania, the state minister for internal affairs, insists that by deploying security forces at the parliament, the government is just doing their job.
The issue of threats, the issue of working against law and order is not accepted, and definitely we as the custodians of law and order
will have to do something to stop it.
Tensions are expected to remain high today as Parliament resumes. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Kampala, Uganda.
Last month, Kenya joined 10 other African countries that are trying to control an avalanche of plastic waste. It's part of a growing international trend to tax or even ban plastic bags that are a big part of the worldwide explosion of trash. It's a good environmental move, though many argue it will cost money and jobs. Viewer's Kevin Enoch reports.
Based on data compiled by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the world uses between 50 billion and 1 trillion plastic bags every year. And each one can live in a landfill for thousands of years. That's why Kenya banned them in August.
It's the constitutional right of every Kenyan to live within a clean and secure environment.
But Kenyan officials say the decision is about more than the environment.
We have also considered our responsibility to global sustainable goals as part of achieving sustainability in our development by balancing between development and environmental consideration.
Kenyan and UN officials say the loss of the plastic bag can be a gain for small businesses that are creating plastic bag alternatives.
Even if you look at the job perspectives, you look at the green jobs, that all this new niche of circular economy, of blue economy, will also open to citizens. It's a wonderful opportunity.
Kenyans are generally supportive of the idea.
And I'm really happy to acquire this bag, an eco-friendly bag. I think we need to adopt an environment that is fit for our children in accordance to the MGGs. And we are calling upon very many people actually to adopt it. It has its negatives and positives, but we need to see the positive in it. And in this adoption.
People who work at small businesses like Mumo Wa Aka that weave plastic bag alternatives see the positive side.
I'm a member of Mumu Wa Aka self-help group, and I do basket weaving. Since I started, I have been able to educate my two children. Since these plastic bags have been banned, I expect we have more sales, and this will enable us to educate our children and also help each other.
The new law imposes a fine of anywhere from $184 to $368 for people who defy the ban. In more serious cases, judges can impose jail time for people who are caught using plastic bags. Kevin Enoch, VOA News.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton, Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 26. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 13 minutes past the hour. Liberia's ambassador to the United Kingdom has been clarifying his comments that former President Charles Taylor should be free to return home. Dr. Mohamed Sharif was quoted as telling the BBC that Mr. Taylor is a changed man who should be freed and allowed to return home and participate in Liberian politics. The Liberian government has since recalled Ambassador Sharif with immediate effect. Mr. Taylor is serving a 50-year sentence in the UK for war crimes and crimes against humanity for his role in the Sierra Leone Civil War. Ambassador Sharif says his interview with the BBC was what he calls miscarried, most probably by local Liberian newspapers. He said his comments about former President Taylor were made in connection with overall reconciliation in Liberia.
I did see that former President Taylor has learned his lessons in prison, that he has been converted to understand, and if he is to come out of prison today, I believe former President Taylor will not be interested in politics, not because people would demand him not to, but because he himself will not love to get engaged in the local politics. We have had other people that have been converted and later on came to Liberia, are living among the citizens and are living peacefully. Some of them have been elected to positions of trust in the national legislature, and they have performed very well and peacefully. This is how we consolidate peace in Liberia, by having trust in our people.
you being the ambassador to the United Kingdom, are you in contact with former President Charles Taylor?
No, I am not in contact with former President Charles Taylor. I have not visited him, which I would love to. I have made that request to Her Majesty's government to have pay a visit to Liberians within the jurisdiction, not only President Taylor, but any Liberian, because when you are representing citizens abroad, you do not divide, you do not separate them from good and bad. You represent Liberians holistically.
You mentioned former President Taylor in the light of reconciliation in Liberia, but you know that even the mention of former President Taylor creates some kind of controversy in Liberia. So do you think his coming back to Liberia will make it possible for any reconciliation?
I did not say he should come back to Liberia. I said, and I repeat, that reconciliation in Liberia must take into account every citizen of Liberia. You cannot reconcile the people of Liberia by separating people, by dealing with certain group of tribes or certain group of people or certain people of certain ethnic group and leaving out others. Reconciliation will not hold. President Taylor was elected in 1997 with 75% plus. I was not in the country at that time, but we all saw how the different observers declared that election to be election by the will of the people. So those people are still the same citizens of Liberia today. Are you telling me, or is someone telling me, that those people do not have any role to play in the reconciliatory process of Liberia? I believe no.
Did the Liberian government recall you because of the comment that you supposedly made about former President Charles Taylor? Were you recalled?
No. My letter of resignation was sent, and which I will forward to you, is dated September 11, sent to the Minister of State for Presidential Affairs for onward transmission to Her Excellency the President of Liberia, rendering my resignation as her ambassador for reasons that were explained in that letter. And when I read in the papers where the president made a strident comment about my unbecoming behavior of a Liberian diplomat, I felt very bad, because I know I do not have any unbecoming behavior. Maybe probably other people who are involved in corrupt practices are considered not to have unbecoming behaviors. But people like us who advocate for her, who follow what she said in her first term of office as corruption being an enemy number one, we have been portraying. But we found out that sometimes when people want to get at you, they create false cases against you.
You seem to take issue with the President of Liberia describing your action as unbecoming of a diplomat. Do you understand why she would think that way, that a diplomat will make a comment like you are alleged to have made?
Well, I don't understand why that statement was made, because to say unbecoming means it sends out so many innuendos out there, too many nuances, too many similarities of what it means to be unbecoming. I know I don't have any unbecoming. I have always spoken the truth, and I've always spoken on issues that are not correct. So if by talking about corruption, by talking about issues that are not straightforward, if that is what you call unbecoming, I don't regret it. I will continue to be unbecoming.
Dr. Mohammed Sharif is Liberia's former ambassador to the United Kingdom, who's speaking with me from London. The Gabonese government says a European Parliament comment calling on Gabon to stop harassing and persecuting its political opponents is an interference in Gabonese internal affairs. Government spokesman Alain Claude Billy Ndze says there are no political opponents in Gabon, but judicial officials will not tolerate anyone who violates the law. Desiree Iname is a publisher of Echo du Noir, or Echoes from the North. He says Gabon, as an economically dependent state, cannot afford to defy the European Union. Besides, he says Gabon is obligated by the Cotonou Agreement of 2003 to implement democratic values. He says the EU wants the Gabonese government to engage in a genuine dialogue with the opposition.
My opinion of that reaction is that the position of a government is a joke. That attitude reflects the mindset of a dictatorship, denying people rights, regardless of human rights and international laws. Second, they are really embarrassed by a page that Ali Bongo's government would like to turn without success. It is a bloody page of the last elections. So I'm curious to see how they intend to make an economically dependent state defying the European Union and the United Nations.
Desiree, what do you mean an economically dependent state? Are you referring to Gabon?
Yeah, I'm referring to Gabon because all our needs, all the food we have in Gabon comes from abroad and mainly from European Union countries. Also that the Gabonese state is going bankrupt. So they would need money from France, from other countries.
According to the Gabonese government spokesperson, there are no political opponents in Gabon. I wonder what that means. And also, the government feels that the European Union Parliament comment is an interference in Gabonese affairs.
I'm not sure of that because the Gabonese government passed what they called the Cotonou Agreement. It's an agreement which imposed the Gabonese Republic to implement democracy in its country. And in case those values, the value of democracy is not respected, the concerned state is exposed to European Union sanctions. It was an agreement. The Gabonese government signed it between the year 2000-2003. And there are nothing they can do but respecting that.
What can you tell us about this opposition leader or member, Bertrand Zibi Abegi? What is his situation?
Bertrand Zibi was a former member of parliament, and last year he resigned from Ali Bongo's political party, and he didn't join the opposition. He had been arrested in Mr. Ping headquarters on September 1st last year and had never been judged. Tomorrow he will be presented to the court. In my mind, what appears is that Zibi's case will be much more a political trial than a normal affair, you know. No fact shows its implication in organizing the turmoil in August 2016. What he is accused of, so it's only a political trial.
So you don't expect that he's going to get fair trial?
I'm not sure of that. He has been jailed since September 1st, 2016, without any judgment, you know.
Desiree Iname is publisher of Echoes from the North. He was speaking with me from the Gabonese capital, Libreville. Teachers and volunteers in Egypt are using patience and kindness in debate to educate some of the children of the many refugee families from nearly a dozen African countries. International organizations like the UNHCR, church groups, and other local NGOs also contribute in the struggle to educate the children. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
African refugee students have the same hopes and dreams of young people the world over, but they also face numerous challenges that their more fortunate counterparts elsewhere can only guess at. Chris Rupke, an educator at the African Hope School in the Cairo suburb of Maadi, tells VOA that African refugee children he works with have often lost one or both of their parents and are living with extended family members.
A good portion of them, I don't have the exact numbers, but a good portion of them would not have a mother and a father. Some of them have a mother, some of them have a father, some of them might be living with aunts or uncles, or some of them might be living with tribal members and they call them aunts or uncles.
Rupke says that one little boy was so traumatized by what he had gone through back home that he was unable to speak until a psychologist at the school got him to draw pictures of what had happened.
And so we had a psychologist that came and was supporting us, a volunteer, and she had him draw pictures. And what he drew was his village. She asked him, draw your village. He drew his father and his mother and his siblings, and they were in pieces. When she said, where's your father? he pointed to some pieces on the ground.
Jean P., a teacher at the African Hope School, tells VOA that when he began teaching at the school in 2003, he and his colleagues went looking for African refugee children under Cairo's bridges and in its public gardens. He learned how to persuade them to come to school.
Well, the school here is free, so we can put you there and we talk. There's food, and when they hear about food, then they come.
African refugee families often struggle to put food on the table. NGOs like Refuge Egypt, run by the Anglican Church in Cairo, helps them with free sugar, flour, cooking oil, and free medical treatment at a health clinic it runs. Despite the struggles to cope with life in exile, most refugee children relish the opportunity to go to school. They love to play with their schoolmates, to have fun, and to learn. Quarters are cramped, and students attend two different sessions, but teachers work hard to help them to learn and do it with love.
And we do know that the students love to come here because they know it's a safe place, and it is a place that they will see love. They will see teachers that care about them and love them and are here to help them to grow into young men and young ladies that are able to make responsible decisions in life.
Ready? Go!
Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
It's the third week of the UN General Assembly in New York, and once again, the Center for Global Development is presenting its annual Commitment to Development Index. The report ranks 27 of the world's richest countries on policies that affect the more than 5 billion people living in poorer nations. VOA's Adam Phillips interviewed the report's two co-authors, Ian Mitchell and Anita Capelli.
What our index does is focus on the richer countries and asks what they do for poorer countries. We look at seven areas of policy that really matter to development. For example, aid, but also trade and environment. And then we rank those rich countries on how much policy effort they put into those different areas.
Who are the great stars in this report and who could use some real help?
This year it's Denmark, which leads the way, followed by Sweden and Finland.
We see the US very much near the bottom of the league. We see East European countries who are relatively new to development in the middle of the table, and the Scandinavian countries are the leaders, but other countries like Germany and France are moving and improving their performance over time.
Why is it important to rate these places? Are you trying to embarrass them?
The idea is to let these rich countries learn from each other on policy. So one of the nice things in the index is that even some of the countries that have finished in the bottom half are still very strong on certain parts of the index. So a nice example is the Slovak Republic. They don't give a lot of money on aid, but they do score extremely well on the environment component. Their environmental policies are doing a lot for the developing world. Some of the things that we consider are the taxation level on petrol and gas in the country, the amount of greenhouse gas emissions per person, how successful the country has been in reducing greenhouse gases. And in the case of the Slovak Republic, they score very well across all of those indicators and are therefore making an important contribution globally.
Why is that a development issue for Africa or these other places if the Slovak Republic is keeping its own air and water clean?
If Slovak Republic does more for global environment, it's going to help us all, no matter where we live.
Exactly. We reward countries that are contributing positively to these things, which you might call global public goods, things that we all collectively share, and the environment is a perfect example of that.
Are there other examples?
The other important examples are on research and development. So this is in the technology component of the index. We think that those insights created and the science discovered are usable by every country. So the more countries are contributing to research and development that can be used everywhere, then the more credit we give them.
Ian Mitchell and Anita Capelli are the co-authors of this year's Commitment to Development Index. And that's it for this Tuesday, September 26 edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Butte.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in. You will be glad you did. I guarantee it.